I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, in his farewell address, President Dwight Eisenhower warned of the pernicious influence of the military-industrial complex in the United States of America. The term military-industrial complex has, of course, been used a great deal since then, especially by anti-war and pro-peace activists. But what does it mean? Well, joining us on this edition of the program to answer that question and to explain what the broader war industry is and how it operates is Christian Sorensen, author of Understanding the War Industry, a primer, a who's who, if you will, of the parties that have reaped the benefits of American wars. A quick side note, though, before we get to the conversation, this was recorded in October. I'm only just getting around to releasing it now, but the information contained within remains as timely as ever. So, with that in mind, my conversation with Christian Sorensen, author of Understanding the War Industry. Welcome to Parallax Views, Christian Sorensen, author of the new book, Understanding the War Industry. Christian, how are you doing today?
Doing very well, my good sir. How are you?
Pretty good, pretty good. So for my listeners that may be unfamiliar, before we get into the book, what is your background and how did you get into this subject of war?
I kind of stumbled into it. After I got out of the military, I began studying the Pentagon's contracts sort of as a hobby. And so every day around 5 o'clock Eastern, the Pentagon puts out contracts that it has inked with corporations. And so over time, I'd take a look at these contracts and just sort of try to figure out what's going on. And, you know, every day it's kind of a jumble, but if you take it over a year and you distill them and you sort them, you can determine what corporations are profiting from war, where the main locations of the war industry are, what the big ticket items are, and sort of the general spending priorities of the Pentagon. And then once you get that information, you can go down many rabbit holes, including, you know, research about these corporations and who's in the corporations and what military units are purchasing the goods and services. So I sort of stumbled into it as a hobby. And then over time, I realized I had enough information to sort of put it all down into a book. And I was fortunate enough to be able to lean on a lot of really good independent journalists and investigative journalists out there who've already done a lot of the solid legwork, including Tim Sharrock, Dana Priest, and Bill Arkin of the Washington Post. They had some really good work out there. Bill Hartung, who does great work. So between their work that I was able to read and my sort of investigation into all these contracts, I put pen to paper, and here we are.
So it's interesting. In the book, you start out by mentioning the 1970 publication of what you call a seminal work, Seymour Melman's Pentagon Capitalism, The Political Economy of War. Now, I realize that book is very, I suppose, outdated, being from 1970. Your book is more in line with the current moment. But what was this book, Pentagon Capitalism, The Political Economy of War, and why did you feel like it was important to reference this book at the beginning of your own book?
So Seymour Melman was an economist, and it turned out in retrospect that the FBI had a pretty long file on him for probably a variety of reasons. But one was he advocated quite forcefully and eloquently for the economic conversion of the war industry into an industry that cares for people, that takes care of human need, that doesn't harm and pollute and ultimately lead to war and death and destruction. And so he put out a couple of books. Pentagon Capitalism was a very good one. And there's still a lot of themes in there that are quite applicable to where we are today. And so when I was getting going on this book, I sat down and read his work. And fortunately, there are plenty of his writings still available for free online. If anybody who's listening is interested, you can go to economicreconstruction.org. And I don't know who runs that site, but it's still up and you can find a lot of Milman's writings on there. And he talks a little bit about what I guess today would be called the Green New Deal. And he was way ahead of his time with that. And he was talking about, you know, a new economic plan back in the 80s and the war economy and what it means to actually embrace disarmament and how we will actually go about economic conversion. And so I was able to draw on his work quite a bit, particularly toward the end when I offer a few ways to address the system while operating within the system. And one of the ways is to basically work with and create local economic conversion committees. These are perhaps within neighborhoods or regional councils that will help determine what the local need is, and they will work with the workers, the local workers, not the executives sitting in Northern Virginia, but the local workers who actually work at the war corporation's regional or local facility. And because those workers know what they're actually producing, they have the hands-on knowledge, and they know how firsthand to convert to a peaceful industry. And so Seymour Melman was way ahead of his time, and I encourage anyone who's listening to go to that economicreconstruction.org website or just Google Seymour Melman, because I still haven't gotten through much of his work, but he has a lot to offer us. And I personally am no Seymour Melman. I am, you know, just an average guy, but Melman approached it from an academic perspective, but an accessible one. You know, there are many academics today, good and bad, who just spout a lot of nonsense, but Melman was very good at conveying things simply, directly, and you know, one of these days we should all listen to him.
Now, I want to back up a little bit. I want to define our terms, maybe if we can,
sure.
Because a lot of terms get thrown around, and I think certain terms have become buzzwords, and you say them, but the people that aren't in the know don't necessarily understand what we actually mean. And the first term I want to tackle is the military industrial complex. You use this term, and some people will just look at you and sort of tilt their head and be like, what is that? Or they'll say, oh, that's that conspiracy theory, right? What is the military industrial complex? Break it down, and what's the history of it? It was first used really by Eisenhower, right?
Correct. So the first main use was Eisenhower's farewell address, and he warned of the military industrial complex. Now, in earlier drafts of his speech, he used the term military industrial congressional complex. And that's what I use because I find it to be more accurate. So if you picture a triangle, you have one side military, one side industry, and one side Congress. Now, the military is represented by the Pentagon, which is the decision-making headquarters of the U.S. Armed Forces, of the military establishment. The industrial side of the triangle is the war industry. Now, the war industry is the corporations that develop, market, and sell goods and services to the Pentagon and to allied governments and regimes around the world. Now, the third side is Congress. And Congress's job is to fund the whole thing. They fund the Pentagon. The Pentagon buys from industry. And Congress's job is also to pass favorable legislation favorable to the war industry and to the Pentagon, insofar as the Pentagon expands overseas and continues to purchase goods and services from the war industry. So that's in broad strokes how it is arranged. Now, it's insulated. And what I mean by that is the American public has no real effect on the MIC, on the military-industrial congressional triangle, because we don't have any effect on the military, okay? We don't have any effect on industry. Those are corporations. And as anyone who's living in the United States today know that corporations are arguably the most powerful institution around. But we should have an effect on Congress. After all, we elect them. Unfortunately, the way our democracy, quote unquote, works is Congress is influenced, is bought and paid for, is bribed, is affected by the war industry before they even set foot on Capitol Hill. And so, and we can get into that if you want, but what the MIC, one of the reasons why the MIC is so harmful is that we have no real effect on it, particularly while we, the working class, are broken up, while we are not organized, while we are at each other's throats over a variety of different issues, while we are divided along racial lines. So, yeah, that's the MIC.
You know, it's interesting. There's a book called Soldiers of Reason by the journalist Alex Abella, which sort of tries to argue that the Rand Corporation is one of the things, or the main thing, that Eisenhower was referring to in that military-industrial complex speech. I know the Rand Corporation makes an appearance in your book, and I think you go a little bit further in defining the military-industrial complex than just saying the Rand Corporation. But I bring up the Rand Corporation because it's sort of technocratic. It's one of the precursors to all these technocratic organizations that sort of just run the country in a way now. What is the role of technocracy in the war industry?
So it gets to unelected bureaucrats, unelected bureaucracy. They are the, you know, some people use the term deep state, but it's, to me, and maybe that I'm just blinded by, you know, the day-to-day contracts or the monthly distillations of contracts, or maybe I'm drowning in the numbers, but to me, the deep state is nothing more than permanent armed bureaucracies. Then they are staffed with unelected people. We don't elect them. They take on a life of their own, they being the bureaucracies themselves. And so you get to the Rand Corporation. Rand is kind of unique within the think tank portion of the overall military-industrial congressional complex. Rand is a think tank, but it's very much part of the government. So it takes a lot of money from the U.S. government, and it puts out, you know, fairly interesting work, and it doesn't dissent on matters of war and peace. It's not going to come out forcefully in terms of, you know, hey, we should bring the troops home or any of that stuff. Excuse me. But it's important to frame this within the role of think tanks. Think tanks are part of the MIC, and their job is to promote views and put out information that is advantageous to the to those who fund the think tanks, to their funders. So, for example, if you are big oil, you fund a think tank, and that think tank will put out a range of information, but that information will never come out and say we should convert to a greener economy, quote unquote. At worst, it'll put out information that will say, you know, climate change is not happening, or if it is happening, humans are not the cause of it. And the ultimate effect is that it helps the bottom line of those who fund the think tank, in this case, big oil. Now, in the war industry knows exactly what it's doing. It funds think tanks very well. In fact, there was a report that came out, I believe this past week, from, I think it was the Center for International Policy, but I could be mistaken on that. And the essence of the study was that they analyzed the funding that went from government and from the war industry into think tanks, mostly those operating within the Beltway. And that funding, just over a few years, topped $1 billion. So you have an arrangement of think tanks receiving money from the war industry, from these major corporations. And in turn, the think tanks put out information that helps the corporations profit. And so when you're talking about the war industry, that means never questioning the forever wars, never questioning why we're in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Somalia, Mali, Chad, Philippines, Colombia, Honduras, et cetera, et cetera. And lately, one of their main roles in order to help industry, particularly the bottom line, has been to put out a variety of fear-mongering, because fear sells weapons, about China and Russia, because we have entered, for the sake of industry, the new Cold War, where cooperation with Moscow, with Beijing, is not possible, according to industry think tanks, and according to corporate media affiliates, whether it's MSNBC, Fox News, CNN, Washington Post, New York Times, et cetera, et cetera. And this is one of the reasons why podcasts like yours are so important, because not only are you not taking money from giant corporations, but you are thinking clearly, you are thinking independently, and you're putting out information that the general public can use. And so Rand Corporation was cited in that $1 billion from government and industry into think tanks study. And I encourage anyone listening to Google that, or not Google that, use DuckDuckGo or another one. But it's important to read that study in full, because it really does show the pernicious nature of the war industry and its full might.
Now, I want to note that we're recording this on October 18th. This may be coming out of a few weeks down the line. So I will try to find that report and have it put in the links to this episode, maybe the show notes. I wanted to get into an aspect of your book that may be controversial to the average American. You mentioned, our so-called democracy. And in a way, you were sort of saying so-called, we call it a democracy. But in the book, you say that one of the foundational elements of your book is that the United States of America is no longer a republic or a democracy, but an oligarchy. Maybe we could delve into that a little bit more. How did we get to this point where the war industry and the oligarchy sort of runs America rather than we the people?
You know, that's a really good question. I think it just happened over time. The problem is that, so think of every war before World War II, and we're a nation that's been at war for a while, and there are a variety of causes for that. But after every war, up until World War II, we stood down after the war. That is to say, we demobilized, demilitarized, and didn't have a huge, massive standing army. Now, that changed after World War II. World War II, mind you, bled right into the Cold War. In fact, there are some historians that say the Cold War started during World War II, once Moscow got really up and running with their industrial might. Now, I'd argue that the industrial might of Moscow was hyped and overinflated by the very U.S. war industry in order to justify the war industry and the Pentagon's own bureaucracy and legal authorities and funding, just enormous, enormous funding coffers. But in any event, when you have a standing military And when you have a standing war industry, worse yet, you have an enormous amount of pressure on the halls of government. And over time, unless you are actively working to keep your democratic institutions robust and vigorous, those democratic institutions wither and die. And it's very difficult to say that we live in a democracy these days. Money rules Washington, D.C. If you are a lobbyist, you're good. If you are a powerful corporation, you're good. If you are the average Joe, you have little to no effect on federal policy. And this came out most famously in a Princeton study by Giles and someone else. The name is escaping me. I think it came out in 2013 or 2011, but I can send it to you and you can put it in the show notes as well. And the Princeton study basically said that the United States is not a democracy. It is not a republic. It is, in fact, an oligarchy. And under an oligarchy, the rich few basically dictate policy. And the rich few, and policy is made for and by the rich. And it's very hard to look at US history critically and say that that is not the case since 1945, since the end of World War II. And this has all kinds of horrible effects. And we're seeing that right now. We're seeing that most certainly with the COVID-19 response. Excuse me. The American public during the pandemic need monthly stipends in order to stay home, in order to stay afloat, and in order to contain the disease. If we stay home and we stay out of each other's faces, the spread of the disease is less likely. And these are based on, you know, scientific fact. Every other industrial nation took care of their citizenry better than Washington, D.C. did with the United States citizenry. Every other advanced industrial nation got monthly stipends. We did not. We got one check of, $1,200. And we're told to, eat it and, keep going on about our lives. And neither party is caring for the American public. Now, at the same time, trillions of dollars are going to Wall Street and corporate greed. So when you look at the COVID-19 pandemic and the response within the military-industrial congressional triangle, it's even worse. How in a pandemic can you deny the public universal health care while at the same time passing a military budget worth roughly $250 billion? So another record high military budget. Now, most of that military budget, mind you, doesn't go to the troops. It goes right toward the war industry to purchase goods and services from the war industry. Now, the US military gets $750 billion this year during the pandemic. Both parties support this, mind you. On matters of war and peace, there is no dissent from the blue team. There is no dissent from the red team. Both parties, as institutions, support this. In that year, the Center of Disease Control got $8 billion. $8 billion during a pandemic. The war machine, $750 billion. Now, according to, it was a Newsweek article in March of this year, 1 year of US nuclear weapons spending, just the amount of money we spend on nuclear weapons, would provide 300,000 intensive care unit beds, 35,000 ventilators, and the salaries of 75,000 doctors. Now, that's criminal behavior right there. Washington, D.C. is demonstrably, both parties, demonstrably not taking care of the American public. Now, in addition to this, and at the same time, the war industry basically kicked it into high gear. So the one of the ways that the war industry influences the Pentagon is to put corporate suits, corporate executives in the high-ranking civilian offices of the Pentagon. So secretary, undersecretary, deputy undersecretary, assistant deputy undersecretary, there are dozens of these offices. And increasingly, they're staffed not by career civil servants, but by executives who a month ago were just in corporate suites in Northern Virginia or in Southern Maryland, running the war corporations that benefit from the endless wars. And so one of these people, her name is Ellen Lord, She's currently the human in charge of procuring goods and services from the war industry. She came from Textron, a very powerful corporation. Okay. She's now Undersecretary of War for Acquisition and Sustainment is the title. It's one of the top positions within the Pentagon. Okay. She, and with the backing of the Pentagon, deemed war corporations and their industrial base to be essential and critical infrastructure early on in the pandemic, thereby mandating that the war industry keep up and running. Now, the war industry had advocated for this, and she came through for this, she being someone who came from the war industry. So, industry basically implemented a few safety measures, much to the chagrin of some of the workers who I've talked with within the war industry. And they doubled down. They basically took the money and kept going. And now you have a situation where during a pandemic, record military budgets, and industry keeps going as if we were not in a pandemic, as if weapons of war have any use these days in combating, you know, the pandemic. So it's incredibly sad. It's incredibly sad. And at the same time, industry is pretending it cares. It is continuing patterns that started before the pandemic, namely the automating of as many jobs as possible. And I fear that as industry sheds jobs during the pandemic and continues to automate, those jobs will not return after the pandemic is gone. So while I loathe the war industry, I do not blame the working class for taking whatever jobs are available. And I don't blame anyone for working within the war industry. If you're making an armored vehicle in Ohio to put food on your table, I understand that. I don't blame you. But those jobs are increasingly automated. And I worry that as they're shed under the pretext of, you know, battening down the hatches during the pandemic, that those jobs are not going to return. And so there's a lot there. But what the in broad strokes, what the COVID-19 pandemic has demonstrated with respect to the military-industrial congressional complex is precisely how insulated it is from the needs of the American people.
Now, in regards to the Pentagon, that brings me to another interesting point that you bring up in the book. It's not necessarily the whole of the book, but I find it fascinating how the media and even Hollywood plays into the war industry, because there's a long documented, this is not conspiracy theory, history of the Pentagon influencing Hollywood. If you want to use the military in your movies, they will look over your scripts and say, take this out, take this out, take this out.
Yeah.
So no, in that regard, what is the role of Hollywood and the mass media in the war industry?
So it's basically complementary to the role of think tanks. So while think tanks put out information that is favorable to their donors, the war industry in this case, their funders, the war industry, corporate media, MSNBC, Fox, CNN, they might disagree on issues that get us divided, that keep us divided, such as abortion or gun rights or the pandemic and how to tackle it. But what the ruling class does not disagree on, and what their respective media outlets, whether Fox News on one hand, catering to a certain slice, or MSNBC and CNN on the other, what they don't disagree on is endless war. They're both completely on board with it. And so the best thing you ever get when you turn into corporate media is basically the opinion of the capitalist ruling class. So you're not going to be informed on matters of capitalism. It's mostly not even going to be mentioned. And you're certainly not going to hear about war profiteers or war profiteering or the bane that is the military-industrial congressional complex. But we have to back up a little bit because only a handful of corporations, I think it was six at last count, own all of the media outlets in the United States. And that right there is not freedom of information. It's not freedom. It's not knowledge. You're just going to get whatever gets the most clicks, whatever infotainment draws the highest viewership, and that is in the chase for advertising dollars. Okay. The corporate media in this country put out what brings in advertising revenue, and they're very sensitive to those who purchase advertisements on their respective media. So one of the things that the war industry does, particularly on, say, the Sunday morning talk shows, is to purchase ads. Now, why would, say, General Dynamics, which makes submarines, advertise to the American public? Nobody's out there buying a submarine. Why would they do that? The main reason is to confine and make sure that whoever is hosting the Sunday morning talk show is not going to bring up the uncomfortable questions, because you can't go against your advertisers. And the same thing with Boeing, the same thing with any of these other corporations. And you'll see them advertise here and there, and it's pretty nefarious. Now, that's just to make sure that the host doesn't get out of line. But the business model, we must remember, is shared across all corporate media. It's about profit. It's not about informing. It's not about engaging. It's not about waking people up. It's not about developing critical thinking. It is about profit. And one of the trends that you've seen recently across corporate media is the hiring of these revolving door types as consultants, to on-air consultants to the various sundry corporate media channels. So you'll see these revolving door types, and by revolving door I mean career MIC officials, people who have gone and cycled in and out of government, war industry, again and again. And now they're making a pretty penny as consultants on corporate media. So you'll see, for example, Mike Morrell on CBS News. Mike Morrell was at one time the acting director of Central Intelligence, director of Central Intelligence Agency these days is the name of his position. And now he's, you know, some security analyst on CBS News. You have John Brennan, who was Obama's CIA director. He's on MSNBC. You have James Clapper. He's on CNN. You have General Jack Keane on Fox News. Now, this is, if any other country did something like this, we would laugh at them and be like, wow, they're so corrupt. Can you look at what the Kremlin's doing now? The Kremlin has, you know, their lackeys on, you know, Pravda TV or something, or RT or whatever. And we would mock them. Now, how is this okay in our so-called democracy? How does that affect the overall nature of our discourse? It's very, very pernicious. And you also have retired generals and admirals and think tank operatives regularly penning op-ed pieces for corporate media, often without disclosing their current ties to the war industry. Maybe they have investments, maybe they're on the board of directors. You see this all the time. It is just so common, it is so baked in as to not even be a scandal anymore, though it should be a huge scandal. And then finally, I would say that private equity plays a major role. There are only a handful of outlets that people are able to turn to that really cover the Pentagon and its operations. And private equity owns most of those outlets. So for example, Sightline Media Group, it has a variety of products, including the Air Force Times, the Army Times, Defense News, Marine Corps Times, Navy Times, C4ISR Net, et cetera, et cetera. These are the main publications that cover the Pentagon, that cover what's going on overseas. Sightline Media Group owns all of these. And a private equity group out of, I believe it's Beverly Hills, actually, owns Sightline Media Group. So you're not going to get, when war is profit, peace is your enemy. You're not going to get any mention of peace or how peace benefits the American public or how it is not in the interest of the American public, of the working class, to participate in these wars, whether in the war industry or whether in uniform, by going over and fighting the working class of another country or the peasantry of another country in the case of Afghanistan and Vietnam. And so corporate media, there's a lot to say about that. But yes, I would also add, as you so astutely pointed out, and it's very important, that Hollywood also plays a role. And in general, like you said, if you want to make a big budget blockbuster, you're going to need the Pentagon's assistance acquiring helicopters, you know, aircraft carrier, whatever, to make your film look legit. Now, that comes with a catch, as you pointed out. The Pentagon basically has script approval. And the same thing applies with CIA. If you want to use any of CIA's knowledge or expertise in order to make a film, they also get to approve your script. So you're not going to get anything that criticizes the bipartisan corruption, the nature of U.S. foreign policy, that basically means, you know, you're not going to bring up a critical-minded U.S. public. You're going to get a U.S. public that is on board with the wars without even questioning the wars. It's harmful stuff, but great question.
So, in regards to the corporations behind the war industry, I found that very interesting because, you know, I think a lot of people in the United States have become prone to trying to explain sort of deep or hard to understand political structural phenomena by using, you know, sort of conspiratorial lingo or terms that reference shadowy super groups. They'll say the Illuminati, or now they'll say the deep state. The thing is, though, as you show in this book, the players have names and addresses. There's power rankings of these corporations. What exactly are the names of the war industry corporations and their power rankings?
Very good question. So we live in a society where corporations hold the most power. And if we're going to move beyond war and we're going to move into peace, if we're going to move from a war industry into industries that create based on human need and based on the natural world and what that needs, then we're going to have to at some time engage in that transition. And that means ultimately that the US working class united and together has to address the US war industry. So who are they? Who are the corporations that sell goods and services to the Pentagon and to allied regimes and governments around the world? The top five are Lockheed Martin, Boeing. So Boeing is a unique case because it has a commercial aircraft division, which is about, say, half its work. And then the other half is its militant unit, which is the what sells to the Pentagon and to allied governments and regimes. And that is called Boeing Defense, Space, and Security. So you have Lockheed Martin, you have Boeing, you have Raytheon Technologies. Now that is a new merger. One of the trends basically since 2010 actually has been mergers and acquisitions within the war industry. So big guys will gobble up small guys, and sometimes big guys merge together. And that's what you had with Raytheon Technologies. Raytheon, which was already a top five war corporation, merged with United Technologies. United Technologies is known for a lot of things, including its Pratt & Whitney brand. Pratt & Whitney makes jet engines. It's one of the top jet engine makers in the world. So now you have Raytheon Technologies, which is just enormous. It rivals Lockheed Martin now in size. And they do everything. They do everything except for making fighter aircraft. The only two corporations that remain that are making fighter aircraft actively today are Lockheed Martin and Boeing, though others make other types of aircraft. So 1, 2, and 3, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Raytheon Technologies. 4 and 5 are General Dynamics and Northrop Grumman. General Dynamics is perhaps the most diverse war corporation. It really does make everything, except for fighter aircraft, but it does make aircraft. For example, Gulfstream, which we know as a jet manufacturer, is a General Dynamics brand. General Dynamics makes tanks, it makes armored vehicles, it makes ammunition of all sizes. It has a very strong information technology division based in Fairfax and in Falls Church, Virginia. And it's doing fairly well during the pandemic, in part because it is so diverse. So then you have Northrop Grumman. Now, those are the top five, and they're probably the most well-known. If there's somebody out there who is a news junkie, you know, you've come across these corporations before. But it's also important.
To be fair, there are other ones that you don't ignore in the book, but those are the top five. So there's other ones like DynCorp and Booz Allen Hamilton, which you do mention.
Yeah. Yeah. Just to round out the top 10, there's L3Harris, there's Textron, there's Huntington Ingalls, which is a ship builder. It is one of the two main ship builders aside from General Dynamics, which makes a ton of ships. And SAIC and AECOM. Now, AECOM is important because it is traditionally a large engineering firm, a project management firm. But one of the trends you've seen recently is these big engineering project management firms, AECOM and Jacobs in particular, knowing where the money is, and that's in the Pentagon. So they have, over time, while maintaining their engineering prowess and their project management prowess, increasingly sold goods and services to the Pentagon. Across a variety of fields. So yeah, that rounds out the top 10, but I'm glad you mentioned Booz Allen Hamilton and DynCorp. Those are also important.
So what's really interesting is that when you look at polling, I think most Americans at this point want to see us leave Afghanistan, and yet other polls show that we want to fight the war on terror. You know, we want to fight terrorists. It seems like there's a discrepancy when it comes to how we understand America's views on the war on terror. Does that tie into this at all?
Sure. It's when it comes to polling, it's tough because it all is about how you phrase the question. So I've seen polls where they phrase the question very simply and very straightforward. It's, do you want us fighting in Afghanistan? And most people will say no. Overwhelmingly, it's no. But then if you phrase the question a little trickier, and some of the polling organizations and some of the media outlets and some of the think tanks get into this, you know, if you say, do you want to defend this nation forward? And you're like, okay, well, yeah, but they'll then say, yeah, do you want to defend this nation forward in Afghanistan? And you're like, okay, well, defend, yeah, sure. And so it's sometimes disingenuous on the part of think tanks when they conduct polling, or government-affiliated organizations when it comes to polling. But increasingly, despite all the propaganda, despite all the lies that were fed, the U.S. working class is realizing that the U.S. ruling class has been feeding them a bunch of baloney, and that when the U.S. working class is united, we can end the wars, and that neither party is taking care of the U.S. public, and that both parties agree on most issues. Both parties are pro-war as parties, as, you know, Democratic Party, as the Republican Party, not the people who sometimes identify as red or blue, but as the parties, as the establishment. They're both pro-war. They're both pro-Wall Street. They both have no problem sending our sons and daughters, brothers and sisters, mothers and fathers off to fight the four corners of the globe against sometimes what is no more than glorified gangs with no coherent strategy whatsoever. They are both fine with Washington, D.C.'s corruption. They both accept lobbyists. They're both not going to, as Biden said very recently, not going to ban fracking. Neither party is going to address the climate catastrophe. So the parties agree on most major issues. And the U.S. public increasingly sees this. The largest voting bloc in the U.S. public is those who abstain from voting. And I frankly don't blame them, because they can see that the game is rigged against them. And so I hope that answered your question, but yeah, that's my take on that.
You know, it's kind of interesting to me. I look at something like the war on drugs, and then I look at the war on terror, and I say to myself, you know, my God, did we not realize what we were getting into? Because, you know, the war on drugs, I believe Nixon was told by people during his administration when the term first started coming into being, this is going to do nothing more than create a narco enforcement complex, because you can't really win a war on drugs in the same way that you can't win a war on terror. You can't win a war against an abstraction. And this has led to a situation where we really do have forever wars. And as long as there are parties benefiting financially from those wars, there's really, you know, no reason for them to end. Is that the point that we are at?
Yes, that's, I mean, I couldn't have said it any better myself. That's a great point. The war industry loves the war on terror, precisely because it's not defined and because by its very nature, you can go anywhere and do anything. The MIC in general, same thing. The drug war is, yeah, as you said, predates the war on terror, and it's just as amorphous. It's just as applicable to anywhere. There have been contracts and U.S. military operations in the Sahara, actually, that have gone after, quote unquote, narco terrorists. And so that just shows that, you know, the globe is the limit, the sky is the limit. The U.S. military has divided the world into basically slices, and it's in order to better manage the Imperium. And the slice that is concerned mostly with Latin America within the Western Hemisphere is SOUTHCOM, that is Southern Command. It is based in Miami, and that is the military's point man, for lack of a better term, when prosecuting the war on drugs. And so in general, why we fight, just backing up a little bit, we fight for three main reasons. One is because war is profit. Number two, it is to control natural resources, whether that is minerals or oil, et cetera, et cetera. Number three is to open up countries to Western corporate interests. And you've seen that in most famously in Iraq in 2003. One of the first things that the U.S. Viceroy, L. Paul Bremer, did upon taking control of Iraq in the early occupation was to issue a series of edicts opening up the Iraqi economy, not just oil, but agriculture and other sectors to Western corporate interests. And so those are the three main reasons why we fight. And the war on drugs is no different. You have US-based capitalists and their extractive industries, whether oil, logging, palm, biofuels, coffee, minerals, fruit, operating in Latin America. They have stolen land. They have destroyed subsistence farming. They have displaced millions. They have killed indigenous people and land protectors. And so you have local oligarchs across Central and South America that use and work with U.S.-trained military and paramilitary forces in order to protect this extraction. Now, these local elites back Washington, D.C. for their own reasons, usually economic. And then you have the Pentagon and CIA in particular, operating out of McLean, Virginia, using overt and covert activity to suppress any movements, particularly of the left variety, that rise up to resist this exploitation. So that's the overall SOUTHCOM way of operating. And it's most famous in the School of Americas, which has been renamed WINSEC, the Western Hemisphere Security Institute or something. I don't remember the actual name right now, but the goal there is to train Latin American officers to then go back to their respective countries and help implement and guide US-based policy. And so the war on drugs runs overlapping with this and in parallel with this. It is more of an excuse to dominate the hemisphere than anything else. Now, it includes dominating countries such as Honduras and Colombia, but also an excuse, as you know, to terrorize innocent civilians within the United States, to over-police Black and brown communities, and to ramp up the surveillance state in general. So we are in quite a pickle right now, and I fear that it's only going to get worse before it gets better.
Now, a lot of people throw around terms like the American war machine, perhaps even the American war industry. But ultimately, isn't this industry transnational?
Very good point. So a couple things on that matter. Number one, I would say that corporations in general and war corporations in particular have no loyalty to the United States. They often use the troops in marketing campaigns and in public relations and the flag as well, but they have no loyalty to the United States. They go wherever the money is. So increasingly, there's something called foreign military sales. And that is when U.S. war corporations sell to allied governments and regimes around the world. And the U.S. government basically acquires the goods and services. It acts as an intermediary. It acquires the goods and services from the U.S. war industry and then facilitates that sale. It's one of the main reasons why we are in horrible alliances around the world with some of the worst anti-democratic regimes, whether it's the United Arab Emirates or the Saudi regime or apartheid Israel or any of these. And so it's really, that's number one. Number two is you see the transnational nature in other alliances, particularly the Washington, D.C., London alliance, the quote, special relationship between the United States and the United Kingdom. Now, one of the underpinnings of that relationship is, of course, the financial sector. So you have London and New York, Wall Street in particular, moving money all around the world, engaging in all kinds of horrible activity. And that is one of the pillars of the US-UK special relationship. But what doesn't get talked about a lot is the war industry. So London purchases a lot of goods and services from the US war industry. And indeed, the US government purchases a fair amount, not a lot, but a fair amount from the UK war industry, particularly a corporation known as BAE Systems. Now, BAE Systems is based in London. However, pointing to the transnational nature of the war industry, as you pointed out, BAE Systems' most productive facilities in terms of profit and sheer output are based in the United States, to the point where BAE Systems functions as a part of the US war industry, thereby tying together what is effectively a client state, the United Kingdom, to the United States. So you have BAE working on every really major big ticket item that the Pentagon purchases from the US war industry, whether it's armored vehicles, whether it's submarines, whether it's nuclear missiles, whether it's the Lockheed Martin F-35 Joint Strike Fighter program, which is the most expensive weapons platform ever created. So that is one of the underreported but very important transnational or links indicating the transnational nature of the US war machine or the US war industry. But it's important just to emphasize that the war machine, the war industry rather, has no loyalty to the United States. It will sell to anyone and it will profit in any way. And the wars must be sustained, the wars must be expanded. If the executives in Northern Virginia or Southern Maryland, where most war industry have their headquarters, are to profit. And if Wall Street is to profit, Wall Street, mind you, particularly investment firms such as BlackRock, are heavily invested in the war industry. Lockheed Martin's top five investors that we know of are not the average Joe, but rather Wall Street investment firms. So the wars must expand. They must be justified. And It's quite the predicament.
So that brings us around, and I know we're running a little bit short on time here, but that brings us around to the role of lobbying. I know you wanted to mention that a little bit more. You mentioned at the beginning we could go deeper into it. What would you say of the role of lobbying? What are the key points?
So there, we know about campaign finance. Campaign finance is you are running for Congress. I, the War Corporation, fund your campaign. And then once you get into Congress, you owe me. I own you. Okay, that's number one. Another pressure point is lobbying. Formal lobbying, traditional lobbying, wherein I, the War Corporation, hire dozens of lobbyists to go pester you on Capitol Hill. And at its worst, across industries, not just the war industry, at its worst, lobbyists effectively write the bills that end up getting passed in the Senate and the House, pointing to the lack of democracy in this country. Now, there are other ways to pressure Congress that are not traditionally lobbying, but function as lobbying. And one I want to point out is the role of pressure groups. Now, pressure groups are typically trade organizations, but they can be other 501c3 type designations. Now, they say that they are invariably educating government. They like to say that a lot. We are educating government. Now, their main purpose is to influence policy, but they carry out four different things, and I'll get to those in a second. I want to name a few first. The Air Force Association, the Navy League, the Association of the United States Army, the National Defense Industrial Association. These sound pretty innocuous. They sound okay, but their main purpose is to influence policy, and that policy is to go to war and to expand the wars. Now, how do they do this? Number one, they issue policy packets. They write letters to Congress. Number two, they say, here is industry's stance on an issue. You saw this very early on in the COVID-19 pandemic. They also arrange congressional testimony. Not always, but sometimes. And so there, you know, you see in a committee hearing, the people who are giving advice to Congress, the professionals, the experts, quote unquote, come from the war industry. That's horrible. Number three, probably most importantly, they administer arms fairs. Any display, any industry display, an arms fair, a symposia, a conference, any industry display, they run those. They administer them in coordination with individual war corporations. So you'll see the Huntsville Global Cyber Symposium or something like that, sponsored by fill in the blank, the Association of the United States Army, something like that. And in those conferences, those fairs, those displays, you basically have the MIC in all its glory getting together and making deals and schmoozing. And there's no outside influence. It's just the MIC for the MIC by the MIC. And then lastly, and this goes very underreported, is these pressure groups will give awards to generals who are four-star generals sitting in the Pentagon. They will get awards from, say, the National Defense Industrial Association. So I'll end with this final example of this just baked in corruption. General Dunford was a four-star Marine. He received the National Defense Industrial Association Eisenhower Award. He then retired. He then went to work 5-6 months later for Lockheed Martin. He showed up on the board of Lockheed Martin. Now, if any other country did this, we'd say, we'd scream to the high heavens, how corrupt are they? Their war industry awarded a sitting four-star general. I believe Dunford was the commandant of the Marines at the time. And in his acceptance speech, he praised industry. This is incredible corruption. Then he shows up after retirement, 5-6 months later, for Lockheed Martin. And Lockheed Martin then leverages his knowledge for greater profit. That is the definition of corruption, and pressure groups are something that I encourage any aspiring or current journalist to really look into, because they exemplify the pernicious nature of the military-industrial congressional complex.
You know what? I'm going to have to ask that you come back on the show maybe in the next month or two, because we didn't even get into the chapters on information technology or the connection between the war industry and the educational system and the sort of weaponizing of the academy. We'll have to get into that in a future episode. But in closing, what can Americans do? I mean, how do you fight the war machine? How do you fight this huge war industry that has so much power? I mean, if we're an oligarchy rather than democracy, what can we really do?
Well, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. We are in trouble. We are in a lot of trouble. We have to face the climate crisis. We have to face the pandemic. We have to face an oligarchy that doesn't care about us. We have to face increasing threat of nuclear war through this great power competition that industry has largely fabricated. So we have a lot in front of us. There are two things that we can do. I'm more a favor of the latter than the former, but I'll give the former first. The former is nationalization. If you nationalize the war industry, that is to say the key parts of the major war corporations that produce goods and services and sell to the Pentagon and to allied regimes around the world, then you have leverage over them. You can forcibly convert them into peaceful technology. That's difficult this day and age, precisely because we are an oligarchy. And if we, the people, want to nationalize something, that doesn't necessarily translate into our quote unquote Congress enacting that. So the other thing they can do is to democratize the workplace. And what I mean by that is right now, the workers at the various factories of the war industry throughout the United States, producing the goods and services, they have no say in how these goods and services are made, in how they are sold, in how they are marketed, and what they do. They just, as workers, produce the goods and services. Who has the say? Right now, under the way we organize ourselves as a society, without democracy in the workplace, the people who make the decisions are the executives, usually a handful of people sitting hundreds of miles away, typically in Northern Virginia or Southern Maryland, make all the decisions on the matters of the US war industry. What the public can do is to effectively seize the means of production. They democratize the workplace. Henceforth, they make the decisions about what they produce. They make the decisions about how to produce it. Do they want to pollute? Do they not want to pollute? Do they want to, say, create for human need instead of war? Do they want to factor in the environmental costs, as largely corporations do not these days? These are the things you can do once you have democratized the workplace. And I encourage anybody who's curious about this to go to Richard Wolff's website, which I believe is Democracy at Work. And that is Richard Wolff, W-O-L-F-F. And he is a real pioneer in talking about this stuff. He's an academic, and he explains it in very simple terms that even I can understand. And so it is, those are the two ways right now. Now, I'd love to get into this more in, when I come back, but we either nationalize or we seize the means of production, because the ruling class in the United States is not going to care for us ever.
Do you have time to maybe just briefly get into that a little bit more? What else did you want to maybe say about it? Because it sounds like it's very important to you.
Sure. I'll just say, right now, the U.S. war industry is the main cause, not the cause, but the main cause of why these wars keep going on. It is profitable. And I mentioned the other two reasons earlier in this podcast. When it comes to democratizing the workplace, it's important to understand that there are many sectors of war right now. So one of the projects I'm working on these days is how to actually go about this. So as it stands, there are many profitable sectors of war. There are something called base operations support services. That is anything to run an installation. Now, how would you convert that into a peaceful industry? Well, that would probably be easier, something along the lines of the ease with shipbuilding. So say you have your war corporation and your main job is to produce ships, warships. Well, a warship is a stone's throw away from just a regular old ship. You just don't arm it. So those industries, those war corporations would have a fairly straightforward time producing, just switching almost overnight into a peaceful industry. Now, with base operations support services, which is everything that it takes to run a military installation, from pest control to some light vehicle maintenance to sometimes base security is put in, sometimes it's taking out the trash and waste management, that type of thing. That can be very easily converted. I mean, what community doesn't need those resources? So it's not a huge uphill battle once the U.S. working class is united, once the working class is not divided along racial lines, along religious lines, along, you know, Second Amendment lines. There are going to be business sectors of war that are going to be harder to convert, particularly, let's say, nuclear weapons. Now, what can you do there? Well, you can basically leverage the aerospace technology to work on space exploration. Because the rockets, mind you, a lot of the classified technology that launches a nuclear weapon into the atmosphere is the same rocket technology that launches a regular old rocket into the atmosphere that is used for space exploration. So it's, I bring these points up because it's important to understand that while it is a huge hill in front of us, if we want to end the wars, the most direct and effective way is to democratize the workplace and really get going on producing toward human need and really get going looking and working with your local neighborhood councils, with your local regional authorities, and not being confined by our existing feeble democratic institutions. We must be able to improve, look critically at them, and improve upon them. So I'm quite optimistic in this regard.
And how can my listeners get a hold of Understanding the War Industry?
So I would say big shout out to Clarity Press of Atlanta. I'm very grateful for them for all their support. They are the publisher. You can go to claritypress.com. You can get it from Amazon, though I would rather you order it through your local bookstore. Any local mom and pop shop can order it for you from Clarity Press. And I would say, I mean, I have a website called ibpoffices.com. It is soon to be called warindustrymuster.com. And then I don't tweet much, but I'm at CP_Sorensen, S-O-R-E-N-S-E-N, on the old Twitter machine.
Also, just want to note, this book has been getting some pretty high praise of a previous guest of mine. Professor Richard Falk had some really high praise for the book. Let me see if I can pull up the quote. Richard Falk said, "A devastating account of American militarism, brilliantly depicted and exhaustively researched in an authoritative manner. Sorensen's book is urgent, fascinating reading for anyone who wants to save the country and the world from political, economic, and ecological disaster. Its message is so convincingly delivered that it will change many open minds forever and for the better." You also have praise from Andrew Coburn, author of Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins, and a few others in here, including Medea Benjamin from Code Pink for Peace. Really getting some high praise here for Understanding the War Industry. So I would highly recommend it. Anything you want to add to that?
No, I just want to say, you know, thank you very much, you personally, for taking the time. It's not an easy issue, but I, you know, it's not easy to stomach, that is. But I really appreciate you taking the time to host me here today.
And I want to thank you for coming on the show, Christian Sorensen. Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Christian Sorensen, author of Understanding the War Industry, available now from Clarity Press.
an excellent, well-researched, and informative read that gives you the qua bono, the who benefits when it comes to American wars abroad. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Amelia, Mark, Martin, Brace, John, Ted, Zach, Gratz, Mickey, and Chase. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, then consider supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Also, $5 tier supporters get access to archived editions of past Parallax Views programs, so check that out. I also have the bonus show, The Week That Was, the latest episode, just recently dropped, and that featured special guest co-host, Chuck Ocelli, filling in for my pal Casey. So check that out if you're at the $5 tier of my Patreon page, which, if you haven't joined yet, patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.